And good afternoon. It's time for the Art of the Hudson Valley. We're here once a month, the first Thursday of every month. The Art of the Hudson Valley. And I'm Chad Weckler, your host for the next hour. And our guest for the next hour is Allison Marchese. And you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM. We're in Greene and Columbia counties, New York, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, and we're also global, you would imagine. We've got listeners all around the world on listening on WGXC 90.7 FM. And if you go to WGXC.org, you can stream, get our program streaming live, and every program streaming live. So Allison is an author, a Columbia County resident, and knowledgeable about many things Columbia County. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, Chet. Thank you for having me.
So what's been keeping you busy writing about the Columbia County?
Well, that's a very good question. I can say that what's been keeping me busy for the last couple of years in Columbia County, back in 2013, I had this crazy idea that perhaps I could write a book about the history of Columbia County. And that came about from having seen a very big old text that my neighbor had, and it was the history of Columbia County in 1857. And I think after working my way through those many pages, I thought, well, maybe it's time to write another one. So that's kind of where I started. And then I was contracted with Arcadia History Press, and I wrote the history, the hidden history of Columbia County, which came out in 2014.
You know, and we were talking, and we just met today for the very first time, and we were talking before we went on the air, and it just occurred to me what you just said is, I think in the United States in the latter part of the 1900s, maybe because of the bicentennial, that there were many counties and towns writing about their history. And that was almost, you know, probably in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, there was a sort of a celebration of history. And we haven't had that in a long time.
I think that's right. I didn't really think about it that way at first, but it did occur to me that with so many people coming to Columbia County, and myself included, I moved here in 1989, which makes me sort of an early pioneer. But I felt like it was home. And when I moved into Old Chatham at that time, the first thing that struck me was the Union Cemetery, the Old Chatham Country Store, the places that had been on the map for hundreds of years. And I looked for texts. I looked for information. So, and then it was when I, myself and my significant other purchased a home in the oldest home in Malden Bridge. It's a 1740s colonial. That really kind of kicked it off for me.
Absolutely.
So I think I was saying to you when we were sitting outside was, I've run into two different types of people. The people that I can't, that don't have any interest in it, but then there's this growing population of people who just want to really get to know, and they want to be a part of, and they want to feel the history of where they live as part of the community. So for me, I love that. I think that's what really drives me, and obviously brought me to do two books and perhaps even more.
And what's the name of your first book that you have there?
The first book is called The Hidden History of Columbia County, New York. And it's available at the Spotty Dog. It's also at Chatham Books. It's in the independent bookstores, of course. And also, if you have to, online.
And I would imagine Spotty Dog does have a specific area for books like yours.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Kelly puts all of the local history books together, and they're pretty popular. So actually, I did a bunch of signed copies also for the Columbia County Historical Society's gift shop in Kinderhook. So a little plug for them. So please stop by there and you can have a signed copy.
Was there one story that got you started to write the book?
You know, it's a, no one's asked me that yet. So let me think. Well, one of the things that really was fascinating to me at the very beginning of this was my significant other is an antique dealer and collector. And he was always bringing home these amazing objects, you know, and it occurred to me that I was more interested in the backstory of each of them. So that was one of the things that really kind of tipped me in that direction. Also, my family history is was one of the things that really goes all the way back to the 1600s in Anjou, France. And when I realized that when my aunt passed away, we each of us got a copy of the history and family tree. And to know that my grandparents and great grandparents meticulously kept that, this was sort of the snowball effect. And then one day, I was sort of in my backyard and found an old dump of things because my house was a carriage house. It was a roadhouse. It had it was sort of a hotel, and it had a restaurant, and it has this really cool arching ballroom upstairs where people were dancing. And I did have a few peculiar experiences in that home. I still do. And so I sort of was snooping around my backyard one day, and I dug up a bunch of very interesting objects. So I think the most interesting object I found was a sort of an Indian artifact.
Oh, really?
And I think that was where the story really was starting, because I live on the Kinderhook Creek, and I had learned that the Mohican Indians used the Kinderhook as a tribunal. They would walk the Kinderhook and they'd camp. And there's some of these stories are in my book, especially the Red Rock stories. And the Mohican Indians are woven into the book quite a bit. I wanted to make sure that that became part of our constant conversation.
Good idea.
So there were lots of ways in which I was becoming interested. But I dove in really not knowing what I wanted to write about, because there's just so much. But I've always been a writer from the days I was writing in college, a short story writer. And I was saying to you earlier, I don't think of myself as a quote historian, but I do, and I'm not a scholar, so probably you'll find a mistake somewhere. Most likely you will. But I do consider myself a storyteller, and that is my favored place in writing is short stories.
So you keep the nonfiction, and do you add a little fiction just to sort of flesh out the story?
I have to say no. I'm a pretty I'm purist about this, because there are several genres now that have they're called historic fiction, which for me feels like kind of an oxymoron. So I very diligently don't do that in my stories. I don't embellish them with dialogue. I don't create an envisioned portion of the story. What I try to do, though, and I think fairly successfully, is to write stories that are entertaining. I pick stories that I thought were unusual, and I like to write them in a context that makes it a read. It's not like you're slogging along for too many pages. So this is interesting. What I didn't know going in, and what happened later, was having been at the Children's Book Festival a few years ago here in Hudson, the kids really ate it up, which was extremely gratifying to see so many young people, really young boys, and asking me questions about specific stories, and they had heard this was included. And so that was really, really rewarding to see a range of people who are interested in that, having students pick it up voluntarily and buy it.
That was always a curiosity of mine, because of my generation, I lived in California, and even in middle school, we had a very thick book about California history. And I don't know if, for instance, here in New York State, do you have the same thing, or you have a thick book about New York State history, or even Columbia County history?
not to my knowledge, that one that was written by Captain Ellis in 1857, that's probably the most comprehensive one, but it doesn't deal with a lot of different topics. It's a lot about patents and lawyers and landowners and businesses and mills, and it's interesting, but it doesn't seem to me, there are pieces of it that's written, certainly. Books have been written about specific towns, and people have done really nice work on the history of Valacia, the history of Hudson, things like that. Mm-hmm. I think, but it's a comprehensive study of the whole county, you know, really getting a history of, not that I'm aware of, I've never run across that, but I would like to do a part two of this book, because I was only able to cover 8 of the 16 towns in Columbia County. It probably won't happen with this publisher per se, because they don't operate that way, but I am working with a local non-for-profit, perhaps through a particular grant, we might be able to work this out so I can do the other towns.
Terrific.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like you to read something, if you're ready, from your book.
So the book, as I just said, it has 8 towns in it. It includes Austerlitz, Chatham, Claverick, Hudson, Kinderhook, New Lebanon, Taconic, and Valacia. And whenever I'm at a reading or a book selling opportunity, everyone asks me, the first question is my town in there? And when I did Hillsdale and I did a couple of other towns, and I had to say no, I always left it with, but there's
more.
There may be more. You know, and as much as I would love to be able to do that, it's a little bit hard to just pull it off on my own. So anyway, this chapter is on Hudson. I wanted to say something about Hudson. And it's called, there's sort of a big chapter and then a subheading within the chapter per the story. And this one's called Spirits, Sulfur Springs, and Seances.
Great.
Okay. So as Chet and I said, we're glad this is a rainy day, because maybe people are going to really listen to this. So, over the course of many years, with the city's feverish growth and equally rapid decline, many people passed away in Hudson. Some perished and departed, and some apparently stayed on. In Haunted Places, the National Directory of Ghostly Abodes, Sacred Sites, by Dennis Hawk, the author clearly states that the Dietz House, built in the 1830s in Hudson, is haunted by Mabel Parker, a woman who moved into the house in the early 1900s and lived there for nearly 50 years. Her family, who continued to occupy the house, reported that Mabel would walk the stairs, seize the covers off those who slept in the second floor bedroom, the same place that she had occupied in life. Not far from Hudson is Stockport. It is by far the smallest of the 18 towns in Columbia County. It was established from the land of the towns of Stuyvesant, Ghent, and Hudson on April 30th, 1833. It received its name from Stockport, England, and the native place of James Wilde, a prominent resident in the town. To the west, it borders the Hudson River, where the Stockport Creek meets the Hudson, and where vineyards grew wildly, producing hundreds of tons of grapes. That was something I never knew.
No, and me either.
And I was wondering if with that fact, maybe there would be sort of this resurgence of a native Hudson wine or something. I have friends who make wine locally, the Chatham Hudson Winery.
Mm.
So you never know. And then some believe that it was there at the foot of the Hudson where Henry Hudson first arrived in Stockport. And if you haven't been driving, I know everyone did the detour this past year,
and
you had to kind of go through Stottsville and around the Stockport Creek there. Then you got a chance to really see what that creek looks like, because it's kind of hidden. With many waterways reaching into the small town, it's made a powerful water system, which the town prospered from. Originally, the northern portion of the town was included in the Powell and the Kinderhook patents and the grants made by Major Abram Stotts in 1667 and in subsequent periods. Major Stotts was a surgeon attached to the garrison in Albany in 1643 and was among the earliest of the immigrants from Holland. Nearby Stottsville was named for Jonathan Stott, who was an intelligent weaver of satinets in Hudson. He located here in 1828 and began manufacturing flannels in a small factory with just 12 looms. A short distance from east from Stottsville is the celebrated Columbia White, or was the celebrated Columbia White Sulphur Springs Hotel.
Mm.
So, just I'm going to take a pause there, but Sulphur Springs appeared in Stottsville as well as in New Lebanon, New York, which if anyone hasn't been to New Lebanon, it's sort of on the eastern side on the way up through the Berkshires just before you get to Pittsfield. And if you head out that way, there's this, what they used to call the Healing Springs, as big as Saratoga was, with grand hotels, and the train was stopped there. And it's, so that's the chapter on New Lebanon. But it's a very fascinating story.
Now, what would be Sulphur Springs?
So the healing waters, they were like, sulfur was considered, I mean, I'm not an expert here, but in the day, the sulfur springs were considered, you know, you'd bathe in them and they would have purative qualities and they have medicinal curing properties. And if you read the book, there's a little more detail about what that cure did and the taking of the waters. If everyone knows this. Hydrotherapy, believe it or not, was born in New Lebanon. The whole concept of hydrotherapy and taking the waters, and that's in the New Lebanon chapter, so. Making you go out and buy the book.
Good.
Okay, so the presence of these springs was noted as early as 1830, and some wonderful cures were reported as a result of their taking the waters. It wasn't until 1855 that Charles B. Nash purchased and opened a house for the accommodations of invalids at the spring. Many who had failed to find relief from medicinal aids were cured by the waters. The Columbia Springs House was created much like Columbia Hall, which has offered cures in New Lebanon. A few yards down the road, not far from Stockport, is the village of Columbiaville. It's there that the Smiths lived, in an old stone house. The Smiths were very influential in the 1800s, and many know this area as Smithville. In this house, a family member by the name of Aunt Rachel was among a group of spiritualists that held seances. The spiritualist movement attested that souls of the dead resided in an astral realm and could communicate with the living. Through traveling medium shows that exhibited spirit rappings, table tippings, and thought readings, as well as published communiques from famous dead people, the belief of spiritualism spread across America. One of Hudson's most unusual residents in particular was responsible for putting spiritualism on the map in America. John Worth Edmonds was born in Hudson in 1799. Spiritualists believed that they could communicate with the dead, and in his book, the Spirit Book, The Encyclopedia of Clairvoyance, Channeling, and Spirit by Raymond Buckland, the author says, Edmonds is the man who has done the most to make the movement of spiritualism the vital force and power that it has become. Around the time Edmonds turned 18, in 1819, he studied law and entered Martin Van Buren's law practice in Albany. Just a pause here. Martin Van Buren seems to somehow show up in every chapter.
Good for him.
For whatever reason, he's in everything. He succeeded in becoming part of both branches of the state legislature of New York and president of the Senate and judge of the Supreme Court of New York. Edmonds was also noted for having overseen the trial of Big Thunder during the anti-rent wars, which is, if you are from Livingston, you must know the anti-rent wars, which happened when the indentured servants of the original patent who were, they were tenants on the patent and they revolted because they weren't getting anything for their rent. And they, so that's another chapter, the anti-rent wars.
I believe that's closer to probably the Massachusetts border or.
It borders sort of like, yes, a little closer in, but it in Taconic, it's in my Taconic chapter.
Uh-huh.
So So during the heated debate between the two lawyers presiding over Big Thunder case, John Edwards put John Van Buren, the second son of Martin Van Buren, and Ambrose L. Jordan in jail overnight to cool off. Edmonds was, in every sense of the phrase, a straight and upstanding citizen. Yet he became drawn to spiritualism after a period of deep depression and contemplation following his wife's death, during which he questioned whether what he heard from preachers was true, and whether there was indeed a life after death. Edmonds first tried to prove that spiritualism movement was fraudulent, but he then became a first-hand witness to the mental and physical medium's work. He became so convinced that what he was seeing was true that he kept a 1,600 pages of meticulous records. When Judge Edmonds went public with his findings in 1853, simply titled Spiritualism, he was attacked by the press, the church, and politicians, and was forced to resign from his post on the bench and return to private practice. It was about that time that Edmonds developed his own abilities as a medium, and between the years 1853 and 54, he and a group of friends received communications. Among those coming from the other side were Emanuel Swedenborg, the original founder of spiritualism, and Roger Bacon, an English philosopher and early alchemist born around 1213, who he believed to have discovered gunpowder. Edmund's daughter Laura also developed powers that allowed her to speak in tongues. Though she was barely schooled in French, while in a trance she was able to speak French, Spanish, Greek, Italian, Portuguese, Latin, Hungarian, and Indian languages. Edmund's best-known writings were in two volumes of spiritualism. His message in the book offered that the gift of knowledge of spiritual things is available to all. Spiritualism gave rise to the belief that spirit contact, which appealed to many celebrated people of the time, including Elizabeth Barrett Browning, William Cullen Bryant, Emily Dickinson, and Edgar Allan Poe, just to name a few, were all investigators and proponents of the new spiritual science. The movement grew rapidly and became so popular in 1926 that an anti-fortune-telling bill was introduced in Washington.
Wow.
This somehow resonates with today's world, but if passed, it would have outlawed the psychic arts for monetary gain, making it punishable by a fine or imprisonment. Harry Houdini even testified before a congressional subcommittee against the spiritualist mediums, however, because of the constitutional guarantee of freedom of religion, the case was dismissed. Edmonds eventually died in 1874 from a long illness while in New York City. In notes he left about his own funeral, Edmonds wished to be interred in the same coffin as his dead wife, and they are both buried together in Hudson. And that's the chapter.
And I wonder, maybe someone who's knowledgeable about our city charter, I believe there is a law in there about not doing seances and fortune telling. And it's been on the books for a long time, and I'm sure it should be changed.
You think that's on the books in Hudson?
I think it is.
Oh, that would be interesting to know. We'll have to do a call-in show next time.
Yeah. Well, that's a fascinating history because, you covered almost 150 years, 125 years in a very short period of time, especially with the spiritualism. And I personally know cemeteries were always like going to your national park. Park people would take picnics and sit down where their loved ones were interred.
Yeah.
They're very popular, and certainly the cemetery here in Hudson is a very attractive cemetery, and I would love to time travel back to the time of the Civil War, especially when so many people were being interred at that time, and see what it was like.
The story about John Edmonds is so fascinating. I actually wanted to write a book just about that. And so I've done a ton of research on the whole spiritualist movement. And in New York State, if a lot of people know about the story, but it really started in New York State, and there's a lot of really great history. There's actually a thing called the Psychic Highway, where mediums were developed. You know, there's just, it's just fascinating. So it's its own topic, which would kind of consume me after I did this book for quite some time. But the funny thing about writing history is you can get off on a tangent for, you know, a good 3 days. Yeah. But if you're trying to hit a deadline, that's not so helpful.
And you were talking about your very old house and finding artifacts, and certainly people in New York City, when they, you know, they've buried a well or an old outhouse, you know, that's where a lot of trash went. So that's mm-hmm. like an archaeological dig.
It's truly like that. If I wouldn't suggest that you go digging up your lawn first of all, but if you have, I don't know how many people who have even gone through antique stores. I mean, you see all kinds of, this is just an archive of like history, and you never know what you're going to find, you know, sort of in your basement, in your attic. Mm-hmm. And the fun thing about doing these readings around the county have been just listening to stories about people who have really discovered some fascinating history about their own homes, or their shops, or their places that they've visited. I ran into a couple recently who just moved to Hudson who have been doing a lot of photography at the cemetery.
Mm.
Very interesting. And they weren't sure if it was mapped or not, you know, if there's an archive. I know there's been a lot of historic preservation discussion in the way of the cemetery. So,
well, your house was 1740, mine's mm-hmm. 1840, and I'm still finding bits of china and bottles,
yeah,
which seem to be pretty, you know, pottery.
I think they did the old heave-o.
Yeah, the heave-o.
Off the side of the porch. And I always, you know, I have my fantasies about my house as a roadhouse, you know, and all, maybe all the parties and the, you know, things that got, were set up over the Kinderhook. So, you know, there's kind of a hillside. So I wondered, you know, how many things got kind of tossed over the edge there. But it is a passion of mine that I plan to pursue. You know, I have a couple of, about four or five different books that I pitching at the moment.
Mm.
And I have actually, I'm working on a young adult fiction, which I, going to deter a little bit away from history for a while, maybe to finish that book. So it's, but it does stir up a lot of great topics, and that's what brought me to my second book,
which will be called.
It's called Hudson Valley Curiosities.
Makes sense as a follow up.
It's a little different, but just sort of along the same lines. But it covers. Let me pull up some notes here for a second. I can give you a little teaser of this, but it comes out in August. It's going to be published by Arcadia Press. And it's separate. It's structured a little differently. It has three separate parts, the lower, the middle, and the upper Hudson Valley. Hmm. So given that I had to sort of take on a larger geographic area, and in each part, there are seven stories. I'm sort of attached to that number.
Hmm.
So I separated it into sort of 21 short stories. And there's a variety of things, from the strange stone structures of Putnam,
hmm.
which includes some UFO interesting stories.
One of my favorite subjects.
Oh, okay, well, we'll circle back to that. There's a story called Outrageous Octagonal Houses,
hmm.
of which I touch on some of them here, the local ones. Creepy Colleges, which is mostly about Vassar. They're going to not like me. They're not going to like me after this. The Irony of Neversink, New York. So these are some of the things. And closer to home, there's stories about, which I brought one of the stories today, called The Curious Case of Oakley Hall the Third. Then this other one is going to be very near and dear to other people's hearts. and now I'm not sure if this is how it's going to come out in the book because it hasn't been edited yet, but it's called Babe's Brew and Albany's Ancient Ale. I'm not going to beat up that. But it's about, part of the story is about the history of beer, which is Albany Ale is one of the oldest productions of beer in the nation. Hmm. So it's a really interesting story about the whole idea of commerce behind how beer was produced and how it was brought over by the Dutch on ships, and it was better than water and it didn't spoil and it didn't have contaminants. So it's an interesting story about the history of ale in our region.
Would it be specifically German as?
That was Dutch.
Dutch?
Mm-hmm. And it all started with home brews because it was part of a food category. And believe it or not, in ancient times, it was the women who actually created beer. They were called brewsters. That's the term for female brewers.
Oh.
So that's the story about. So now everybody's going to be rushing to the Spotty Dog in August.
Absolutely.
To learn about brew. But and I also talk about a story about the Shakers, because it's such a broad topic and there's so many different ways. And I included that in the first book. So I kind of took off at a different angle about Shakers' inventions in the second book.
Well, being that we're in the city of Hudson, any peculiar stories you could share about what you know that you could talk about?
You know, I'm not sure how much of the new book I can talk about. Without it being first sort of, I'm not sure, but, well, here's one of the, if we're going to talk about octagonal houses, so it's a broad subject anyway, but so octagonal houses, so that there's one or two that we can see locally, but if you go throughout, Hudson Valley, there were 125 originally octagonal houses here. And the whole science, there's a whole science behind the eight-sided home. And so the new book, there's a chapter on the guy who created these eight-sided houses in Hudson Valley and the whole philosophy behind it being a healthier style home. So and the man who created them was a phrenologist. A phrenologist.
Yeah, there you go.
Is hold on, take a breath here. The phrenologist is the science that they believed that by feeling the bumps on your head, I know this sounds strange, they could tell about your character. So there was the bump of knowledge. You know, these little bumps all over your head. And there's actual models. I know this because my significant other had one at one time. They were phrenologists, like a head with all of the map of the specific regions where each portion of your head told a story. So in this book, in my new book, I talk about the relationship, how this phrenologist created eight-sided houses and how that became part of his theory of health. It's a very kind of a intricate story, but
when would the first house have been built?
I'm not sure. Let me see if I brought that. I didn't bring that. So those facts are not in my phrenologist's bump of knowledge.
But 19th century?
Yes, and there's one locally down in Columbiaville, which people have driven by a million times on Route 9. There's one there. But without, you know, doing the spoiler alert here, I think that's one of the more interesting stories in our region.
Would the library in Red Hook count as one? I think that seems to be an eight-sided building.
I don't know for sure because I haven't seen that one, but there's probably, I know which one you're talking about now. Yes. In the book, I don't have like a map of each of them, But if you go to the Red Hook Library,
that would be another book.
Yeah, there's so many. it's mind-boggling how so many stories that could be its own investigation. Mm. But I think I have a propensity for the more stranger things, like even sometimes in the realm of ghosts, and that really attracts me. So I'm doing a big investigation now on for a new book about more of that spiritualism and things like that I'm gonna pitch this year.
It seems from our conversation, from what I have recalled, that we live in a very historically rich region. I think primarily starts with the Dutch and if we're not talking about the indigenous tribes that lived here, but the book that I really enjoyed was The City of the Center of the Earth, which was written.
Is that new?
That came out a few years ago out of research out of Albany of the archives from the Dutch. Dutch were very fastidious in writing down everything. That book particularly reminds people how Dutch we are rather than English.
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, the Dutch were much more progressive and a matriarchal system, and much more, just much more progressive in general, I think, from doing all the reading. And the English are the ones who came over and really
gobbled it up,
clamped down on everything. Exactly. No offense to the English, but it was different cultures and different ways of living. And yeah, I agree. Albany, we were over in Albany the other night, and I was pointing out that down by the port of Albany, when you come into Albany down on Madison Avenue, if you ever go out that way, all of those Dutch style homes are still visible down by the water there. And they're now in sort of bad shape, and there's, sort of kind of the part of the Albany that's lots of crime going on, whatever. But you can still see those Dutch homes and the Dutch style period piece homes there and buildings. And it's really so rich with history. Just the region is just so rich with history. And New York State, as a matter of fact, I was out in Rochester for another reason yesterday, and just the architecture out there, even the old farmhouses, the brick old farm places, just spectacular. And if you're like me and you are curious, there's many, many ways to research. So that was something I had to learn going into this. Was the first book I really made an effort to get to all the places because it was Columbia County. Mm-hmm. The second book, I couldn't get to everything that I wanted to see, but physically take a look at it. But there's the internet has got its own maze of finding. But I went from, I always try to go from primary sources. So rather than, websites can be very misleading. You need to know where their sources come from, because you can always see at the bottom of any article where they're finding their information. So what I suggest to anybody who's doing their own research is to look at those articles, but then look at the primary resources that they went to and look at those articles first, because you're looking at things that are two steps removed. So and somebody's interpreting the information. So you want to keep looking back and looking back and looking back for the primary sources, autobiographies or biographies or articles that were written, firsthand accounts. You want to see if you can really get to the source of things. And of course, the internet has a million ways to do that. There's a lot of books that are now archived. One of my favorite places to go is Google Books, because they open up to you digitized out of print books that you can read till you can't read anymore. So the process of writing history is really, you have to be very diligent and pursuant of the factual information as best you can, and then document everything. Everything has to be. You'll see the bibliographies. I think this one's 12 pages long.
Wow.
But yeah, this one's very long in this book. And it's just one of those things that if you get the bug, you start looking, you can spend a lot of time reading. And I think one of the things that I did well is to condense large amounts of information into short stories.
That's good.
That was the task.
I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM. This is The Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm Chad Weckler, and our guest this afternoon is our author, Allison Marchese, and her book is Hidden History of Columbia County. I'm glad you, looking at your cover, New York.
New York.
Because there are a lot of confusing, Hudson, I always like to say, we're Hudson, Columbia County, New York, just to sort of let people know where we are. And you were also talking about, which I told you, I have been a genealogist probably 30 plus years. And so before the internet, it was always going to libraries and repositories and cemeteries and small historical societies to get what information there was. And often it was not duplicated. That's the single source for some information. And I would hate to think that, yes, there's probably a possibility of some of that history is now lost.
It's, I think you've hit on a really good point, because part of the reason I wanted to write these books is to highlight the preservation or the need for preservation. Mm. A lot of the history is lost, I think, especially the visual history, the photographs, documents. It's the best of our ability, I think, people who have anything that's worth documenting or has documents, they should find the right establishment to take it over that can safeguard it. Museums or historical societies that have archives that are well kept. I know that the Columbia County Historical Society has done a tremendous amount of work last year on getting their collection put together and creating archives, making it public, opening their buildings again. They've done a tremendous job. I know the new library in Hudson's got a Hudson history room. I'm going to be at the Claverick Library on April 22nd doing a reading, and they have a new place that they're trying to get open, but I think they're not quite there yet.
Yeah,
they need some help.
Need some fundraising, a little bit more. Yeah.
And I'm going to be at Barnes & Noble this Saturday in Poughkeepsie with other Hudson Valley writers. We're getting together. There's a group coming together to talk about books and write and read and do some signing. So there's a lot of people who are pulling for this and working together to make it so that if there are people at all interested in it, and people who can contribute and people who do have archival things, to keep them and keep them safe if possible.
One of my joys was reading a lot of the history of, if you go to a library, like I said, usually in the 1880s was very popular for some reason. 1888, 89, a lot of counties throughout the country put together these very thick books, and they went town by town, and there are profiles of certain individuals. And I always wondered, how did they get in there? Sometimes I find an ancestor, sometimes I don't. But I think they may have paid for that. But the language, it was always wonderful. Reading newspapers from the mid-19th century, the use of the English language is not at all like it is today.
Well, in the olden days, right? So I love to tell my young friends that in the olden days. At that time, I think when newspapers, you really have to consider the fact that that was one of the primary sources of communication and entertainment.
Yes.
So feature stories were like watching a movie. You'd see like a whole page. I love reading old newspapers. It's a great pastime. The stories were just colorful and sometimes tawdry and revealing in ways that you just couldn't believe they just talked about all kinds of gore and awful things and train wrecks and, you know, but it wasn't so much time, you know, to try to get the story out in the short amount of time because you only had so much ad space and the newspaper was worried about revenues. It was really like the place where they got to do creative writing and fun. It's super fun to read.
And it's a great way to find out if you have ancestors that go back 100+ years, there's so much social reporting in old newspapers, which reveals if, you know, your Aunt Sue and Uncle Jim were visiting you, often that would be in the newspaper as
yes.
Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so are visiting their niece.
Spent a week in Hillsdale visiting, yes, at their niece's wedding. The detail of life, right? The texture of life was always in there. And so-and-so fell down the stairs and broke their leg last week and was recovering nicely. It's very funny.
And or, you know, Mrs. So-and-so is still feeling, unfortunately, poorly. We hope she gets much better.
Well, I was unable to come to the tea at the church because she wasn't feeling well. I know. And, you know, the sense of community that created, I can only imagine that you really would look to the newspapers to understand what was happening around you. Because in those days, you really getting from place to place took a long time.
Yeah, I think we're losing historic detail, which was finite in earlier American history, where now we're moving so quickly where we're losing a lot of nuance. And even doing reports, everything's condensed. Type is bigger, where the older newspapers, type was very, very small. Almost need a micro, to look at it very carefully because it was chock full of news.
Yeah, the magnifying glasses magnifying, came in handy.
But now type is bigger, information is simpler, the narrative of detail is disappearing. And it's great that you're kind
of
bringing that.
Well, they say
that
people aren't reading books anymore, but I don't think that's true. I think that there's a joy in everyday normal life. You know, the detail of normal life, reading a book, seeing your friend on the street, taking the time to talk in the grocery store. I think what's nice about seeing Hudson's growth is that's still part of it's become an even bigger part of the culture is to have community. Yes. And in, as this community grows, I'm hoping that doesn't go away, that you do go to your local farmers. You are stopping and talking. You aren't in such a rush that the detail of everyday life isn't lost. But, you know.
Well, if you were to have a magic ball in front of you, could you, I mean, I'm speaking editorially, look into the ball and say, this is potentially what I could see happening in Hudson or Columbia County 10 years from now, 20 years from now. I mean, I wonder if, you know, taking the information back 10 or 20, can we take that 10 or 20 and look forward?
You know, what I've witnessed having been in this county for 25 years is there is a growth. It seems to be accelerated. I see the farms all being, some of the older farms being taken up with new businesses, and there's a new growth and there's new ventures. You know, what I hope will happen is that we retain the rural integrity of Columbia County, and that it doesn't get so much, it doesn't become like Westchester with so much growth and so many houses that you just forget that was an open field one day and that there was a stream there and there was a birds used to live here. You know, so I worry about that part of our growth, but hopefully this will be a conscious way in which people move forward. I hope that people don't forget that, you know, Hudson, we had Henry Hudson. he was here. You know, he was the majority of American history, a lot of it, It was in New York State, in New York City, in New York, where we live. We were the touch place where a lot of American history. And I also hope that people are, they'll probably get in trouble for this, but really honest about the real history of our community and not forget the Native Americans and not forget the immigrants and not forget how this place was built. So we need to be inclusive. That would be my hope for the future anyway.
Well, I like how you've in your stories have sort of you talk about the topography, which might be gone now or will disappear, whether it's streams. Or original paths that maybe later became roads. That type of history is always fascinating to me to sort of, if you can, what was there before. Caleb Carr, talking about authors, and I used to love his books. I haven't checked to see if he's written anything lately, but he did a great novel having to deal with Ballston Spa. And a mystery story, and he keeps it somewhat factual. That's the historical fiction, and it goes from Boston Spa down to New York City and Hudson River and the trains, and it's a murder mystery, and those I particularly enjoy.
They're very entertaining. I think that I shy away from those books while I'm writing history. Because it's just the style of writing that, but I certainly, when I have free time, I'm devouring lots of books. In that free time, there's time for entertainment for that. So, but thank you. This has been great.
And let's just check the clock.
Yes, we have to check the clock.
We have 3 minutes
left. Oh, we have 3 minutes left.
Yes.
I'm just trying to see.
Maybe a little portion of another.
Yeah, I'm going to see if there's.
By the way, I'll remind our listeners that at 3 o'clock, 3 to 3:30, we have a radio theater and artist and Wayfarm programmer Tom Rowe. It has his latest edition of, I think it's about Donald Trump. And that'll be coming up a little after 3, but back to Allison.
Okay, well, before we go there, I'm going to read a little bit about the Mohican Indians.
Oh, good.
So this is under the Chapter 5, Kinderhook, and I call this one Kids of the Creek. In 1609, when Hendrick Hudson sailed up the river, it's likely that he anchored his ship near Kinderhook. The word Kinderhook was used when Hudson sat anchored in the great river. From a distance, he saw the Mohican Indian families grouped on the shore. It was then he applied the Dutch word for children's corner, or kinderhook. In his journal, Hudson wrote, "I sailed to the shore in one of their canoes with an old man, who was the chief of the tribe consisting of 40 men, 17 women. These I saw there in a house well constructed of oak bark and a circular shape, so that it had the appearance of being built with an arched roof. The Mohicans, who Hudson met in what is now called Columbia County, were from the Lenni Lenapes, which means original people. These Indians were descendants of the Algonquin language tribe, who once controlled a considerable portion of the area. In order for the Dutch settlers to make their new land their new home, they would need to negotiate land sales with the Mohicans. Yet, this is where cultural differences turned to grave misunderstandings, and ultimately, these misinterpretations changed the course of destiny for the native Mohican tribes forever. The hidden history in Kinderhook and throughout the county really starts with the Mohicans. The little-known fact is that the Mohicans, the Native Americans in general, didn't believe in land ownership. For them, there was simply tribal territory. Most Indians believed that everything had a spirit. Europeans, on the other hand, believed that nature could and should be tamed and improved by humans and their effort, Thus, when the Europeans came to trade for land, the Native Americans didn't understand their concept of outright ownership. They thought it only meant to share. While William Cronin summed up their mentality in Changes in the Land, he said, "Only the land lives forever. How can a human being own land?"
Very well put. And we should remember that the city of Hudson, that's not the original name. It's Clavering Landing, I believe.
Clavering Landing, right. So that's in the Kinderhook chapter, that goes on to talk a little bit more about the Mohicans and, you know, the interactions and later on how that worked out. But I think that's a good stopping point.
I think it is. And people, listeners, you are listening to The Art of the Hudson Valley, and I'm your host, Chad Weckler. If you're interested in listening to this program again, or you know someone who would like to listen to it, WGXC.org has a great archive. Many of the programmers have their own pages, sometimes on Facebook and Twitter, and this program will be archived for future listening. Thanks, WGXC, for doing that. It's like an audio library of creations that, like we have just done with Allison Marchese.
Well, thank you, Ted. That was great.
And we are coming up at the 3 o'clock hour. I want to thank all our listeners for listening to WGXC 90.7 FM. You can listen locally here in Greene and Columbia counties and also globally at WGXC.org. I want to thank our listeners.